I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. It is 1:34 PM on January 24, Wednesday. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Ortiz, Representative Tomaszewski. Today, we will have a presentation on the FY 2025 fiscal. We will hear a presentation FY 2025 fiscal overview from the Legislative Finance Division, aka Alexi Painter, Director. You members, go ahead and feel free to ask questions as we go through. Although, if we get pressed for time, we will change that. But Mr. Painter, if you'd like to come forward, put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Painter, I'm the director of the Legislative Finance Division. So, start out with an update on the broader fiscal situation, go into some details about the fall revenue forecast, talk about the FY24, an update on the current fiscal year, then go into building the fiscal year 25 budget up to the governor's budget, and then turning over to the long-term view. So start out with slide 3, shows revenue and budgets since FY19. FY19 was the first year of the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund, so it's sort of the start of our current fiscal system where we have that as our largest source of general fund revenue. To orient you to the slide, the area in the background is revenue. The bottom is petroleum revenue. Above that in orange is non-petroleum revenue, and above that is the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund, or the POMV draw. The bars in the front are the budgets in those years. The dark blue at the bottom is agency operations. That's the day-to-day cost of state government. Red is statewide operations. Those are operating costs that don't fit into an agency budget, like debt service or retirement payments. The gray is the capital budget, and then the light blue at the top is the permanent fund dividends. So a few things to note here in this slide. When the budget exceeds revenue, then we have a deficit. If the reverse, then we have a surplus. And since we've had the POMV draw, we have had 2 years with budget surpluses, fiscal year 22 and fiscal year 24. We have had 4 years with deficits, fiscal years 19 through 21 and then fiscal year 23. The governor's budget again proposes to have a deficit in fiscal year 25. Despite that kind of mixed results, our savings balances have actually been pretty steady over this period because those surpluses have made up for those deficits in terms of draws from our reserves. So at the beginning of FY19, we had about $2.7 billion combined in the CBR and SBR, the constitutional and statutory budget reserves. Those are our two main budget reserves. At the end of FY23, it's estimated that we had, again, $2.7 billion combined in those two accounts. So through FY23, we're actually at a pretty similar place in terms of our savings. And I think the lesson of this slide is that since we've had that POMV draw that stabilized our revenue somewhat, we have actually run relatively balanced budgets, particularly in the last few years since we've had difficulty obtaining the three-quarters vote for a constitutional budget reserve draw. That's meant that we've had to run balanced budgets. We did get one in the supplemental in FY23, and that's why we have a deficit that year. But when we were building the budget, we had to build it to balance because we didn't have a CBR vote initially. And so the result has been, in actuality, relatively balanced budgets. We still have what we refer to as a structural budget deficit. When we get to the long-term view, we can talk about what the impact of that. But if we followed all of our current statutes, we would have a budget deficit. That's sort of what the governor's budget represents here on FY25. He's following the statutory PFD, and therefore we have an approximately $1 billion deficit. In past years, we have varied the PFD amount and the capital budget amount based on available revenue and ended up roughly balancing. So there's kind of a gap between the reality where we've been budgeting year by year based on available revenue, mostly varying those two items, and then the current statutes on the books, which would be, as the governor's budget is presented, a statutory dividend and therefore a deficit.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, thank you very much for this slide. This is really easy to look at and read. I very much appreciate it. So nice to see once you see that blue bar moves above the purple, that means the budget isn't balanced. And yet you're reflecting, I presume, on FY25, what the statutory, as you said, PFD, in real dollars for those at home, could we help appreciate what the numbers we're talking about? I think in FY24, for example, I think our PFD, we did agree to a number that was north of 1,000. And then what does it look like for FY25 if we were to give it as a statutory check amount? And then what would it need to be if we were to stay within the purple, for example?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So in FY24, we appropriated 25% of the POMV draw to the dividend. That was $881.5 million. That paid out $1,312. In FY25, the estimated statutory dividend would be $2.3 billion. It's still an estimate because it will rely on investment returns this year. So $2.3 billion would pay about $3,500 a person. I think I have the exact number on a future slide.
Thank you. And one follow-up, if I may. And so right presently, if we were to give this statutory amount, I think you mentioned $1 billion short, roughly. And that's not inclusive of our discussions around public education and things like that yet, correct?
Chair, Representative Calvin, yes, that's correct. With the governor's budget, we have just about $1 billion deficit, slightly less than that. Again, we'll talk about in future slides how that budget may go up throughout the process this year.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to the next slide, start the revenue discussion. So this slide shows the daily oil prices since November of 2021 going through last Friday. For the Alaska North Slope crude, that's the price that we get for our oil that we produce here in Alaska. And we can see that it's quite volatile, where prices have gone from somewhere in the $70 range to over $125. Even in the last year, we've seen prices peak near $100 and now in the upper 70s the last few days. We've seen a lot of volatility. At current prices, and the current revenue forecast, the amount of revenue we get for every dollar of increase in the price of oil is about $45 or $50 million. So a single change in a dollar can mean, you know, $45 to $50 million, and prices change by that every day. The challenge the legislature has is turning all of this volatility into a stable, more stable budget, which we'll kind of go into in later slides how that works in the forecast. But if we just follow the trends from day to day, it would seem we would go from broke to rich, month to month. But I think in reality, we've had a relatively stable forecast over this period, which we'll talk about.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, to the chair, to Director Painter. So just on the dollar to $50 million revenue equation, the other day we had DNR folks in here and even some of our production forecast folks, and it was noticeable that the current amount of revenue we have in excess of our $73 barrel budget is around $210 million, even though we have a $9 increase in our average oil price. So to me, because of, again, lower production and CapEx, of course, through ongoing projects on our slope, that's more like a $1 a barrel equals $20 million question as opposed to 50. And I just want to get your comments on that.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I have a future slide that talks about the change in the forecast that we'll get into that in greater detail. So I'll answer the question at that point. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. And I want to note for the record that Representative Foster has been here since the beginning of the meeting, but apparently I left his name off the roll call. So let the record reflect that he is he is in attendance. All right. Thank you.
Okay. So then more volatility. Here's our investment revenue. So I mentioned that the percent of market value draw has been our largest source of revenue in recent years. This is a slide on some of the history of our investment revenue. So the blue line is the actual investment returns of the permit fund corporation with that investor permit fund. The red line is, for comparison, the performance of our public employee retirement system that's invested by the Division of Treasury. You can see that historically, they move in tandem as with markets. They've performed very similarly over the last decade. Going forward, PERS has a slightly higher projection than Permanent Fund Corporation. Historically, it's been the opposite by a little bit. So they are very close. However, if we just budgeted based on investment returns year to year, as we do with oil, we would have extreme volatility in our investment returns and in the available revenue each year. Instead, we turn that volatile revenue source into a more stable one by applying a percent of the market value of the permanent fund. So we don't look at returns from year to year, investments from year to year. We look at the value and then average them over a time period. That results in a very stable draw versus just chasing the returns from year to year. So this next slide, slide six, shows that calculation for fiscal year 24 and fiscal year 25. So fiscal year 24 is based on an average of the total balance of the permanent fund from FY18 through 22. 5% of the average of these numbers is $3.5 billion. The FY25 draw is an average of FY19 through 23 returns, balances. So it ends up being $3.66 billion. There's been a lot of discussion in the building about whether a 5% PMV draw is the right number or not. One thing that's often cited is that while the fund is increasing, the effective amount we're drawing is less than 5% of the current balance because we're averaging historical years. And in fact, the FY24 PMV draw is about 4.6% of that last year, and the FY25 draw is about 4.7% of the last year of the average. So if you just didn't average, we would have, a lower rate to achieve the same result. But there was a huge spike in value in FY21. So in 2 years, it's possible that we could be looking at the effective draw being higher. It could be 5% because we're not seeing a rising market in the same way because of that one spike and then the market going back down. So that the rising market works to have a reduced draw right now, but in a couple of years, if investment results don't improve, it's possible that it will not result in a lower draw as it has. So a concern that I think this committee talked about and the Permanent Fund Corporation's board has talked about extensively is the sufficiency of the earnings reserve account to make those PMV draws. So as I said, they're very stable, the calculation, but our ability to make those payments is not necessarily guaranteed each year because of the value of the earnings reserve account has to be sufficient. So the permanent fund has two accounts. There's the principal that is non-spendable, and then there's the earnings reserve. We can only spend the realized income. So they have this calculation that's statutory net income, where investment returns are realized as we sell assets or receive dividends or interest or rental payments. That becomes realized income. And the projected statutory net income is lower currently than the total return. That hasn't always been the case, but it often is. For FY25 and beyond, Permanent Fund Corporation projects that they will receive 6.65% of their value in statutory net income. If you do the math with 2.5% inflation, a 5% PMV draw, you add up to a number that's a little bit higher than 6.65%. The result is that the forecast is that there will be a decline in the balance of the ERA going forward. So this graph comes from the November history and projections report by the Permanent Fund Corporation. Just turn that into a graph that separates out in the blue at the bottom the following year's POMV draw. So if we want to ensure that we always have at least next year's POMV draw in the account, that's that amount. And then the red is the projected amount of the realized, meaning spendable, earnings reserve account balance beyond that. It shows that it's projected to decline year over year. The big drop from 22 to 23 was because of very high inflation. The inflation proofing transfer is based on actual inflation. We had 8% inflation. So that inflation proofing transfer was $4.2 billion. The result is that by FY33, based on the straight line projection, we would have $4 million in the ERA beyond what is needed for the next year's POMV. That's definitely cutting it close. However, in a probabilistic world where we don't have straight line investments, there's a higher risk of not having enough money because a bad year, you know, will potentially put you in the hole. So our probabilistic modeling shows that there's a 54% chance of having an insufficient ERA balance to make the full POMV draw over this forecast window if we inflation-proof fully every year. If we said, well, we're not going to inflation-proof when the ERA balance drops below what's in blue there, the following year's POMV, then that percentage would drop to 39%. That's not what the statute reads. That's just, you know, a policy intervention we could make. And I would note that the legislature last year did take action recognizing this is a problem. This committee, when it passed the budget, did not include inflation proofing at all. And the other body's budget capped the inflation proofing transfer at the equivalent of 2.5% inflation. So if actual inflation turned out to be higher, it wouldn't blow up the amount like it did in FY22. And in fact, the actual inflation calendar year 23 for the US CPI turned out to be well above 2.5%. And so that cap did result in something like $1 billion remaining in the ERA rather than being transferred. So it did have an impact. So the legislature recognized the problem. I don't assume that you're going to just draw it to zero, but I'm raising it to try to get there. And I can answer a question now before I do my last vote, if you prefer. Okay. Then sounds like we might. So I'll last bullet. Part of the reason of, okay, why is realized income low? A lot of it is due to the investment allocations that the permanent fund has had, and the results have been that their private equity investments have not dropped much during the negative markets of recent years because companies don't go out and get an investment round when their valuation would go down. So in a down market, you don't see private equity go out. The result is that 70% of our unrealized gains that we're sitting on right now that could become future realized gains are in what we would call illiquid assets, so private equity, private income, and real estate. We're not going to go sell our mall in Virginia to realize income. It's an income-producing asset. But part of our unrealized gain balance is the increase in the value of that property since we bought it. And then those private markets, we don't necessarily control when we exit. We want to wait until a company that we've invested in goes to an IPO to cash out our investment. That's how we'd maximize it. But that may mean we don't get income from it for years. And so the result is that we've had less realized income in recent years because we just don't have that stockpile of unrealized gains currently. The forecast going forward relies on a rising equity market to create those realized gains. And I think the high likelihood we're seeing of an insufficient balance really reflects the chance of what if that equity market doesn't perform well? We could not have gains for an extended period.
I just wanted to make sure we let the record reflect that we have been joined by Representative Benjamin. And next up, we have a question from Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, to the chair, to Director Painter. Thanks for this slide, Alexi. There's a lot going on here. I think I want to start off with, I love your modeling. I'm curious if you considered that this body might simply not take a full percent of market value draw. And if we chose not to take a full percent of market value draw, we would dramatically reduce that potential risk exposure down the road. I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Through the chair, Representative Sapp, yeah, that's one of the ways we could mitigate the risk. And I think, you know, one thing I want to emphasize is I'm not putting this slide out to, you know, say, oh, we're doomed. It's to point out there's a potential problem and there's a number of policy levers the legislature has to deal with this. One would be to reduce inflation proofing. Another would be to reduce our draws. Either way could result in ameliorating this problem.
Representative Benjamin, and followed by Representative Ortiz.
Yeah, it's very difficult for me to see the legislature not taking full draw. I mean, the probability of that is pretty low. It's theoretically possible, mathematically possible. But in reality, and I'm not trying to counter your message, Representative Staff, but just moving out of the theoretical realm into the, you know, the reality realm, if you will. But I just want to thank you for devoting a slide to this topic, because I don't think enough legislators, much less decision makers or people in the general public, really understand the full impact of what statutory net income means and how important it is, and potentially, depending on what the market does, as you point out with the slide, how much of a slippery slope it could be if all the factors go against us relative to the liquidity and the value of the earnings reserve and our inability to take the corresponding action, which, in my view, is the necessity to pass legislation, hopefully, to create an endowment and not to get away from all this. But that's a whole different topic. But I just want to take a second, Madam Co-Chair, to underscore that this is really an important term that I'm not sure everybody really understands. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the Chair. This is going to end up being kind of a little follow-up on the comments just made by Representative Edgman. To what degree does these potential issues at least partially get resolved if we were to take a step to just get rid of the earnings reserve account and combine the two and be limited by law to a certain amount of draw from year to year to year on the total value of the account? Does this particular issue get alleviated if we were to take a step like that?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. So if we constitutionalized the percent of market value draw and collapsed the earnings reserve into a single endowment with the principal, we wouldn't have an ERA, we wouldn't have a sufficiency concern, we would just be able to take the 5%. That's how most modern endowments are structured. This two-account structure was very common when we set up the permanent fund in the 1970s, very uncommon in endowments today. The legislature actually did take a similar step with the Public School Trust Fund in, 2018, which is an endowment of the state. We used to have two accounts. We had all sorts of problems with how much do we spend each year? Is there enough money? We just collapsed into a single endowment, and it's been pretty automatic since then. So it is something we've done before and is kind of fitting with the modern way most funds are managed.
Representative Scapp.
Yeah, my apologies, Madam Co-Chair. I just, through the chair to Director Painter, just kind of wanted to make a quick comment. Certainly, I believe in kind of fiduciary responsibility here. But when we talk about inflationary pressure and statutory net income exceeding, our ERA draw exceeding the inflation, of course, total value of the net income of the fund, if we combine the funds and we take a 5% POMV on the entire valuation of the fund, and that POMV draw is less than inflation and fund performance, we are effectively drawing down the entire permanent fund. Isn't that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Staff, that is the risk with any of these draws, that if the total return is less than inflation plus your draw, yeah, you could draw down the value of the fund. If you continue to take the full draw, the ERA provides a limiting mechanism, I suppose, in that you could run out of spendable money before then. Again, I would hope that the legislature would adjust the draw if we started to circle the drain. I think generally, when we look at these projections that look like doom and gloom, we're going to run out of money, it's really just a prompt to act. And generally, I've found the legislature does act. But it is possible that we could just keep drawing the balance of the fund with an unsustainable draw. It's possible for sure.
Representative Josephson.
Through the Chair. So one way to combat that would be to continue to require, under true endowment, inflation proofing. Would that be a way to resolve the threat of erosion?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, if you had a true endowment, there wouldn't be anywhere to inflation proof from and to. I think you would just want to set the draw to be no less than or no more than your returns minus inflation. So instead of saying 5%, you'd say the actual returns minus the impact of inflation. You could have it be a moving target or reevaluate that based on actual experience. For example, one thing I've heard proposed would be to cap the draw in the Constitution and then have the statute be able to be lowered and changed, or again, to set up a different formula. We're kind of getting a little afield of this, so I don't want to go too far, but there are mechanisms you could do to make sure that inflation is accounted for in your draw percentage.
Yeah, just a quick sort of concluding comment so we can move on here. You know, it wasn't too many years ago that when we had DNR and the Department of Revenue forecasting oil production and oil prices, we got basically the entire revenue picture. These days, that's all changed ever since the passage of Senate Bill 26 in 2018. And it just strikes me that it's at some point here, maybe we could have all three of the entities at the table, not just the oil side, but the investment side as well, because that complete the picture. But my concluding comment is that, you know, having had all three of these presentations throughout the last several days, and with your presentation today, Director Painter, that to me, there and this slide really underscores it, we should be budgeting very conservatively going forward. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, so moving on to slide 8, directly discussing the revenue forecast. This is kind of getting to Representative Staff's question earlier. So the fall 2023 revenue forecast compared to the spring forecast shows higher prices in both FY24 and 25, but it also shows lower oil production, higher lease expenditures, and higher transportation costs, which have a negative impact on our revenue. So the result is that revenue overall increases, but by less than you would expect based on price alone. So going through these different tables here, in FY24, the difference in revenue is $221 million increase, but prices increased by $9.39 per barrel between the forecasts. So you'd think simple math, you know, 9.39 times 40 or 50 million, that's going to be bigger. Well, there's these other things to consider, which is production is down by 26.1 thousand barrels per day. Lease expenditures, which are costs deducted by companies before they start paying their production taxes, are up by $755 million. And then I don't have transportation costs, but those are also up. Then in fiscal year 25, the revenue is up by $79.1 million, but the price is up by $6. So again, you know, $6 times 50 million, you'd have 300 million. Where did that revenue go? Well, again, reduced production by 34.2 thousand barrels a day, and lease expenditures are up by $1.6 billion with a B. So those lease expenditures being up, and we'll go into more details on these in the following slides, these things result in less revenue than we would expect with the price alone. So sometimes the price can kind of mask these changes going on in the production forecast. I think both DOR and DNR, when they presented in this committee, said that this forecast really is a kind of a shift in terms of where we're going to get our oil in the future and what we're seeing in production. And it really is a pretty market shift from the previous year in the production forecast and the underlying variables. The cost, the price going up a little bit kind of papers over that, so it looks like, oh, we have a little bit more revenue. But then when you start to look at the fundamentals, there's actually a pretty big shift that happened with the forecast.
Question?
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, so the lease expenditures, they must necessarily, although we're talking FY25, is this anticipation of Willow and Pica?
Through the chair,
What else is going on in the North Slope?
Yeah, I'll get into that a little on the next slide, actually, so I'll answer that. So starting with production, so the two big things is just understanding how is the production forecast calculated. And the Department of Natural Resources laid this out, but just to review for those who missed that presentation in the public, or to remind everybody, with these future fields, they don't include 100% of lease expenditures and 100% of the production for every potential field. They do this process called risking, where they reduce the amount in the forecast because there's a chance that it won't happen or that the project will happen after the initial estimate. And so this year, there was a great increase in certainty of both the Willow and Pica fields, particularly Willow because It cleared some federal hurdles and cleared that final investment decision by the company that meant that now it can be fully put in the forecast or put into a higher category because it has a final investment decision behind it. And the result is that those that production and those lease expenditures are now not risked nearly as much as they were before. And that results in higher production in those future years. We'll talk about why it's lower in the earlier years on the next slide, but higher production in the later years, but also higher costs in every year. So there's some increase in operating costs as well. So it's not all these capital expenditures. They're just due to inflation and other costs. There is some across the board increases that we're seeing in operating costs. The big difference is those capital expenditures from those two new large fields are much more certain. And as a result, production is far more certain, which we'll see on the next slide, but it also means in the short term, where the companies can deduct those lease expenditures against their taxes, we get less revenue. We'll get more revenue once that production comes online, but not necessary. But in the meantime, we may get less revenue at any given price than before. Can I answer your question? So another slide with a lot of numbers. I'll try to explain it a bit. This slide compares the production forecast from last fall, so fall of 2022, to the fall of 2023 production forecast by unit. So you can see where on the slope are we now, is the Department of Natural Resources now looking at more production versus where are they looking at less production than a year ago? And there's a few really notable trends here. One is that there's lower production in both the Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk main fields. Those are kind of legacy fields. Compared to a year ago, the Department of Natural Resources is expecting significantly less production from both of those, but they are expecting more production from the Prudhoe Bay satellites and the Kuparuk satellites. Those are the newer fields. So that in the out years kind of offsets those production declines in the early years. But again, not every barrel on the North Slope is equal. Because of the gross value reduction of new production and because of the differences of land ownership, not every barrel of oil produces the same amount of revenue as every other barrel of oil. So we don't necessarily get as much from these new fields as we do from those existing fields. Another trend is in the NPRA, that's the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska. There's two fields that really represents. The Greater Moose's Tooth field, that's what's producing now. It has a large reduction. The new well there has been experiencing some production difficulties. And so the projected revenue from that is much lower, or projected production from that is much lower than a year ago. Since the NPRA is on federal land, we don't get royalties from that, and so the impact on our revenue is lesser than if it were on state land. In the later years, you see the impact of that Willow increased chance of coming online with much higher production forecast starting in FY30 than on the previous forecast. That other field, that largely represents PICA increasing, but then there's some other fields that are there that are not included in other fields. So the result of this is you see lower production in FY24 and 25, but that's really, a lot of that is due to the NPRA, but also due to the shift from Kuparuk and Prudhoe Bay to the satellites. And then in the later years, you see much higher production, but a lot of that's coming in the satellites and NPRA, where again, we get a little less revenue because of both land ownership and potentially the gross value reduction. There's a lot of data here, so I'll pause for sinking in as well as questions.
I just want to make note for the record that we've been joined by Representative Kronk. Representative Josephson.
First of all, I'm curious, whatever staffer put this together did it. Exceptional job. That's one thing that strikes me. But we reformed GVR slightly in like 2017, so it's time limited or it's price limited or something. Can you remind me?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this was put together by Connor Bell, our economist, and I'll say thank you, Connor, for putting this together based on data in the two revenue sources book that he compiled. So, yeah, the change that we made was that if prices exceed $70 million for any 12-month period for 3 years, then a field can graduate, as it's called, from the gross value reduction early. So normally it takes 7 years to graduate from the GVR to the non-GVR production. If you have prices of $70 or higher for 3 years, then it can graduate early. One of the many complications here that I was hoping to not have to get into, but we can go there, is that the DOR's price forecast, which I have in the next page, dips below $70 starting in FY28. And so the result is that if you're looking at what is GVR eligible and what is not, in those out years, that's being influenced in part by their price forecast being at $68 or $69. If you ran their entire forecast at $70, you'd see a very different result of what is GVR eligible and what is not. That $70 number is a really important one because of that GVR calculation that makes it, I think, really difficult sometimes to just do a clear comparison of what will get a GVR and what won't, and then how that production will work. I talked to the Department of Revenue about maybe showing if prices were $70 versus if prices were $69, what production from GVR and non-GVR fields would be, so you don't see that crossover. I think it makes it really hard for me and for you, I'm sure, as well, to figure out exactly what's going to be eligible for GVR or not. It's just a very complicated system that we put in place. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, slide 11. So the slide on the left shows the last three forecasts, the prices. So this is the last 3 years, sorry, the last three fall forecasts. So fall 2021, fall 2022, fall 2023. And you can see that the price forecasts are relatively close in the later years. They're all, there's a bit of variation at the beginning, but really they're all showing oil somewhere between $65 and $70 in FY29. I mean, it's not a very large band. Revenue is actually on the right, even more tightly banded from the years because, as we've seen, price expectations move up a little bit. We've seen those cost expectations also go up. So the difference in revenue is actually only about $500 million in these mid to later years between the high and low forecasts. So, you know, while I started with that slide that showed that extreme volatility in oil prices, the futures market that these forecasts are based on have actually been giving us a pretty consistent picture about what they expect oil prices to be 5 to 10 years from now. And so for long-term fiscal planning, while we do have that volatility from oil, there has been surprisingly little variation in what our long-term fiscal picture would look like in that medium to longer term, which, you know, aids the legislature if you're trying to generate a long-term fiscal plan that, yeah, oil may be going from $70 to $100, but the forecasts just have not been quite as volatile as those day-to-day prices.
Thank you. And I'm going to go back to the complicated slide. As you mentioned, each barrel of new oil has a different value to us. And I know that you talked about the price point of 70, et cetera, but I'm also thinking about other nuances. You know, we're clearly investing in the new fields by giving up near-term revenue, right, in exchange for expected future revenue. PICA costs aren't immediately deducted since they don't have current production, but WILO costs are, right? How much more value, given the time value of money that everyone talks about, do we get from a PICA versus a WILO, if you could comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I'm not sure that I'm prepared to comment on the time value money on that, but you are correct that when PICA enters production, it will have a large amount of carried forward lease expenditures that it can, that operator can then use against future production. Whereas WILO, there may be some if they go below zero in terms of production tax value, but most of those, the value of those credits will go to against current revenue. That is a big difference to the state in when we'd get the money, but I can't speculate without seeing it. I would note that the Department of Revenue is working on updating their WILO project analysis that they prepared last session for the new forecast, and I think they may be able to present that next month. I'm not sure if they've done a similar analysis for a field like PICA, though, which would be very interesting to see.
Yeah, thank you. One very brief follow-up. And my recollection of when we heard from PICA was that we would start seeing things turn around in 26. And I might be reading this improperly, but I'm looking at 26. I remember thinking, all right, we can hold on if we budget conservatively, as Representative Edgman mentioned. But I'm now looking at this forecast more like 27 instead of 26. Has that changed, or is that just that I didn't have it right in the first place?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I think if I'm remembering the Department of Natural Resources presentation, they have, I think, a higher likelihood that PICA will be a little bit later than previously. So that's where you're seeing that big increase in 27 is shifting it, but it's also more likely to happen overall. Have to ask the Department of Natural Resources. I'm just trying to go off of memory of their presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Okay, any other questions on slide 11 as well before I move to a different switch gears from revenue forecasting? Well, I guess one takeaway slide. So I'll do that one and then we can switch gears. So the overall takeaways from all these revenue slides. So the increased certainty of the Willow project in particular is evident in the forecasts with increased lease expenditures and increased future production. Revenue impact is negative while the project's under development, but it'll become positive when it enters production. The new forecast has lower production from some of those legacy fields like Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, and then higher production from the satellite units of those fields. And despite some significant shifts in the fundamentals behind the petroleum revenue forecast, the overall anticipated revenue is not a huge difference because price increases have kind of canceled that out. But it is still a significant shift in those fundamentals that I think is worth this committee's attention. And we can see some of the impact of that when we start to talk about the 24 budget and in some of the next few slides.
Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair to Director Painter. I just want to kind of point out for the record and people watching, Alexi, that though these last couple of days have been a little negative when we talk about the state's revenues, but this is a result of the largest economic investment on the North Slope in the history of the state since our legacy fields. We're talking $10 billion or greater than $10 billion in capital investment. Thousands of new jobs in the town that I live in. And I haven't seen this much activity in Fairbanks in a long time, looking for all the staged and development of things going to the North Slope. So I just want to say it's going to be a rough couple of years, I think, for this state's revenue picture. But there is certainly a bright light at an end of the tunnel. Thanks.
Thank you. That's for emphasizing that.
Okay, so moving on to the update on the current fiscal year budget. So I'm actually just going to jump to the next slide. This is kind of the writing version. When I did this in the other body, I talked on this slide. It's better to look at the picture. I think it's easier to understand. So when we finished the FY24 budget and then the governor had his vetoes, we ended up with approximately $292 million surplus based on the spring forecast. The FY24 budget, and that's the black line here. When we passed that budget, we had this provision that said that if revenue exceeded the spring forecast, and that's the dollar amount, not the price, but the actual dollar amount of revenue expected in the spring forecast, if revenue exceeds the spring forecast, then it wouldn't just be available for spending. That additional revenue would be split 50-50 between the Constitutional Budget Reserve, our main savings account, and an FY25 energy relief payment up through the first $636 million. That's estimated to pay about $500 in energy relief. That's where that number came from. And then anything above that would just go directly to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. So the result is that for fiscal year 24, we have kind of this picture showing here where if we get to prices that give us the spring forecast revenue amount, we get this surplus of $292 million. If prices are higher, if revenue is higher, that's not an additional spendable surplus. Those additional amounts would go into that energy relief and CBR amounts. That energy relief would top out at the amount to pay $500 a person. The CBR would be all of the rest. So basically at any price that results in the spring forecast for higher, we have that $292 million surplus that's available to spend. If prices are lower, then we could have less. If they're below $71 a barrel, we would have an unfilled deficit. Right now, the Department of Revenue is saying about $82 a barrel for the average, and we have half a year in, so it'd take a pretty substantial drop the last bit to get down to that area. When we left session, we said that based on the spring forecast, we estimated that the spring forecast revenue amount would start at $73 a barrel, and we would top out of this split between energy relief and the CBR at $83 a barrel. Because of the shifts in the revenue forecast that I talked about in the last few slides, those trigger points have changed. So now, to get the amount of revenue that was projected in the spring forecast, it's not $73 a barrel, it's $78 a barrel. And to get the amount to pay the full energy relief, it's not $83 a barrel, it's now $90 a barrel. So those goalposts to get the full energy relief have significantly shifted. As a result, even though prices are $82 a barrel forecast, which is near the top of what we thought would be pay the full energy relief in the spring, now we're projecting that that would pay about $175 a person, $110 million into the CBR and into that energy relief payment based on that $82 forecast for FY24. So a significant shift. But again, the good news is we have a surplus still of $292 million that's either available for appropriation or, if it's not appropriate anywhere, would lapse the CBR at the end of the year.
Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the Chair, Director Painter. So I'm going to kind of echo our Co-Chair Edgman's earlier comments. I mean, so this is like very concerning to me because these are huge misses, right? They're huge revenue misses. So when we talk about our budget being based and balanced at $73 a barrel last fiscal year, only to find out that it actually took $78 a barrel this fiscal year, the past fiscal year balance. I mean, that kind of house of cards can start getting away from you really quickly, right? So I'd be interested, probably not now, but later on down the road, to hear suggestions from the Legislative Finance Division to kind of ensure how we can better kind of forecast these in the future. Thanks.
Through the Chair, that was mostly a comment, but I'll just say that, you know, it's interesting that this year, a piece of good news, the final investment decision on Willow, what made such a big difference to our revenue forecast. And, you know, when we were building the budget last year, I think that was something that was on people's radar. Was part of why we left with a surplus was because there was some risk of that. But it is relying on oil. You can't just look at price. Those other things do matter a lot in terms of how much revenue.
Representative Josephson, were you next? And then Representative
yes, Chair, just to clarify, the delta between the 73 and the 78, and for the full energy relief, I think you said 82, now 90, something like that. That's because of less production and higher lease expenditures. Those are the causes?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, yes. And then also the higher marine transportation costs, but primarily those two factors.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the Chair. Mr. Painter, your revenue forecast, you depend on DNR and Treasury, or Division of Revenue and DNR to give you those forecasts. You're not producing the numbers. You're calculating from them. But the revenue, the production forecast, you don't do your own, correct? We take what DNR says the production forecast is.
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, yes, that's true. We use the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Revenue's forecast. Because of the nature of our oil revenue, much of the data needed to get accurate figures is company-specific, and therefore we can't replicate it without access to confidential taxpayer-specific information. And just the result of having relatively few oil taxpayers and then strong confidentiality laws means that it really is difficult, I think, for the public or us, anybody using public data, to match DOR's numbers, but they can explain why it is because of the company specifics. It's just, it's a limitation for anybody but those departments to really provide detailed data like that.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
Okay, so in FY24, moving on to slide 15, So, as I said, there's $292.7 million of spendable surplus in FY24. The governor's initial budget release started spending a little bit of that with $17 million of UGF supplementals. Director Sanders went into those a couple of days ago, so I'm not going to repeat that. I would just note that more supplementals are due next week. We'll have a clearer idea of what all those supplementals are. They had one placeholder in their fiscal summary for fire suppression. We'll see what the final number looks like, or the next version of the estimate looks like next week. There are other items we might expect. There may be a Medicaid supplemental. There may be corrections in other agencies, but we'll get a much better handle on that next week. But for now, there's just $17 million of known supplemental requests that eat into that surplus.
Madam Chair, just real quickly, if I might.
Representative Joseph.
We talked about how we've stayed away from the CBR, but last year the supplemental we paid for out of the CBR. Isn't that right?
Through the Chair, Representative Joseph. Yeah, last year's supplemental included a CBR vote because prices dropped. Based on the amount of the actual revenue came in a little bit higher than the forecast, and then based on the amount of lapsed appropriations due to the high vacancy rates primarily. I don't know that all of that deficit filling language or really any of it may have ended up getting used. We'll have a clear idea when the state's comprehensive financial report is released, which was due statutorily in December, but we're hoping for February or March as it's been the last 6 or 7 years. Okay, going on to FY25. So when we start building the next year's budget, we start with what's called the adjusted base. I think in a lot of past presentations that I've given in front of this committee, I've breezed through this pretty quickly. But we made a bit of a change to the adjusted base, so I want to linger on this more than normal. So I'll apologize to the public. This is getting into wonky budget territory, but hopefully this will be useful for the committee. So when we're building the next year's budget, the starting point is typically the adjusted base. That's kind of a stop between last year's budget and then the governor's budget. That is equivalent to last year's budget minus one-time items and then plus adjustments needed in the next year on a statewide level, such as changes to formula programs and salary adjustments based on negotiated increases or health insurance costs, things like that, that are needed to maintain services at a status quo level. So that's a bit of a shift from how we defined the adjusted base last year, and I'll explain that. But essentially, the idea of the adjusted base is that you can clearly see by removing those one-time items and by putting in those statewide decisions, you can clearly see the impact of the governor's specific policy proposals against a clean starting point, the adjusted base, versus looking at last year's budget where there's a lot of things that are not policy decisions like removing one-time items. It gives you a cleaner starting point. It's typically what's been used for subcommittees as their starting point and a lot of times in the legislative process to have that cleaner place to start. This year, we modified the adjusted base a little bit from prior years to include changes to formula programs. Previously, it was often difficult to distinguish policy changes from changes in formula amounts. For an example, if the governor was proposing to partially fund a piece of debt reimbursement, it was hard to tell what's the policy change he's making versus what is just the formula change, the amount that we owe changed, and that's the underlying change. So putting those automatic changes and those formulas in the adjusted base helps us identify more clearly those policy proposals of the governor that differ from the previous year's budget. You may recall in past years we would talk about a current policy baseline. The adjusted base now represents that current policy baseline. So hopefully simplifying things, we don't have to say baseline as many times referring to different things, but we're incorporating more changes into the adjusted base. And it sounds like the Office of Management and Budget plans to use the adjusted base more as well with these changes. So we should be using more similar terminology going forward. For items that were funded partially, we would show the adjusted base the same formula we did last year. So if we, in some years, we had partially funded school debt reimbursement 1 year, we would show the impact of partially funding it again as the adjusted base, or the PFD, where we show we had a formula for it, it wasn't a statutory formula, we would show that formula with the new amount as the adjusted base, and then you can clearly see the governor's shift back to the statutory draw as a difference from that. We'll go through in the next few slides all the changes in the adjusted base so you can more clearly see what the baseline is before you see the governor's policy changes. So slide 17 deals with one-time items. So there were $165.3 million of UGF one-time items in part of the FY25 budget. The largest of that, more than half of them, was that item in the middle, the K-12 additional foundation funding. That was designated a one-time item outside the formula, so it comes out in the adjusted base. Some other items that are notable here, in the Department of Education, the governor submitted quite a few new programs as permanent items. The legislature's budget switched those to one-time items to review them again this year. That's the Alyeska Reading Academy, for example. That was a $5 million item. They were designated as one-time items that come out in the base. The governor is asking for most of those items to come back in the new budget. So that shows up as a change to adjusted base, but it's really just making something permanent that we made a one-time item last year. And there's also items that the legislature had added explicitly as one-time items, such as a grant to the Alaska Travel Industry Association. We gave money to the Alaska Gasoline Development Corporation as a one-time item, Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. A bunch of items that we said, these are one-time items. We don't want them to stay in the base next year. These all come out in the adjusted base, so we, again, have that clean starting point going into next year.
Representative Galvin. Representative Hannon to follow.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson.
Are you finished with this slide? Yes, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair. The one item that I see in here that I didn't notice through OMB was the child care line item here at $7.5 million, looks like. I wondered if you have any explanation for that. I'm really grateful to see it, and I just want to make a comment that it's something that stands out to me as something that I didn't see with OMB. So if you have any comments.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So last year, the legislature put in $7.5 million of general funds, I believe also federal funds, for child care benefits to enhance what was declining federal money as some COVID funds have gone away. That was a one-time item as designated by the legislature when we put it in. It sounded like, so the governor has a child care task force. Those recommendations have not yet been finalized. We may see some of the items from that task force come in the governor's amended budget, but that'd be different potentially than the $7.5 million that was designated as a one-time item, potentially a bridge to those recommendations. But again, they were one-time, so that'd be a policy difference to put those in if they come in at government.
Okay, thank you. I think then what I'm hearing, Chair, is that because of it was there last time, you've put it here this time, but that may change depending on the work of the task force.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So these are one-time items from last year. We're just backing all of these out. So the governor may put them back, and some of these he is putting back, but this is just the process to get there. First, we back them all out.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Painter, can you tell me, because I can't remember, both the Public Defender Agency for 1.9 and the Division of Public Assistance 9.5, and whether both of those were additional staffing that we had as 1 year, because I thought we were increasing public defenders and our staffing at public assistance. I thought some of them were permanent, and then some of them were 1 year, one hires to catch up.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So there's both of those items, I believe, were multi-year appropriations where they were effective across FY24 and 25. In the budget, they count as using FY24 revenues. They count as an FY24 cost, but those will be available over multiple years. So then the governor has additional items this year on those, some adding to the base and some permanent. But those items last year were these multi-years, so they would start in 24 and are counted against the 24 budget, but not against the 25 budget because they're using previous year's revenue.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Representative Josephson, yeah.
I understand that you backed this up so that we have a clean view of what's in the base and what was eliminated through one time. But do you have a chart that shows, so if the committee is interested in these items and wants to restore them, is there some simple way to say what the governor of these items has restored?
Through the chair, Representative Jefferson, we don't have that now, but we could definitely provide that. That's helpful.
Let's go ahead and work through this until work through the adjusted base, and then we'll stop for additional questions after the adjusted base section.
So the next item is our formula programs. So start with K-12. There's a reduction in the formula projected of $30.1 million of unrestricted general funds. Part of that is a shift to the public school trust fund. That amount goes up, offsets general funds. So the state cost is going down by $27.2 million in that same statutory formula. I would note in the bullet there that that's not really necessarily because the amount going to districts is going down. It's that the state share of the amount going to districts goes down. So the way that formula works is we calculate basic need based on the base student allocation times the student count, the adjusted student count, and then that's paid for by multiple payers. So one is municipal governments through the required local effort. As property tax values go up in those communities, that increases the minimum required local effort because it's based on a mill rate of their tax value. And that decreases state costs. It essentially shifts the costs from the state to municipalities. Then increased deductible federal impact aid. Again, that's something we can deduct. More federal impact aid means we can deduct more. The state pays less, but it's not less money going to districts. It's just shifting that it's paid for from federal money versus the state. There are some student count changes that result in a $2.2 million decrease. That's actually offset by a $3 million increase from the Alaska Reads Act that allowed $3 million more of pre-K money to be added in each year before the sunset of that program. So more pre-K students are counted in the formula by $3 million each year. So while it looks like the amount is going down, the amount of districts is actually almost the same because the student count versus that pre-K funding balances out to a similar amount. What we're really seeing is a shift from the state funding it to other payers funding the formula. Other ones I'll call out here, school debt reimbursement. There's a moratorium that goes from starting in July 1st, 2015 to July 1st, 2025 that stopped new debt from being issued. The result is that our amount to pay each year goes down because it's all older debt at this point. So that's going down by $9.65 million of all funds. And the REAA fund, Regional Education Attendance Area Fund, is also going down because those move in tandem. State contributions to retirement is up by about $46 million because of higher calculated liability to those funds based on the June 2022 valuation. So those are on quite a bit of a delay. There's also a cost of the state as an employer, which we'll see on the next slide. This is just the state's share that increases for the state as paying on behalf of school districts and municipalities or local governments. Okay, moving on to the next slide, or I think our last adjusted base slide. So these are the salary adjustments. So as I mentioned, the first one is the increase for the state as an employer with PERS, and then a slight decrease for the state as an employer with JURS, the judicial retirement system. That's an $11 million UGF increase, $22.7 million all funds. There's increases in health insurance costs. Then there's the series of union cost of living adjustments. These are from previously negotiated contracts from prior years. We're seeing those next year costs. We actually have to approve the money each year, even though we approve the first year of the contract. We have to approve each year of the contract for them to take effect. This does not include any new contracts. There's three unions that are currently negotiating. They have until the 60th legislative day to get us those contracts. They have not given us agreements yet. So this is just those existing unions. Those other three unions are not worked in yet. And in addition to that, when Representative Josephson's bill passed that increased the salaries for exempt bill employees a few years ago, there was some language that dealt with, that compared the supervisory unit to exempt employees, that said that if supervisory unit got increases, that would go to exempt employees as well. Future legislation would be needed to make that happen. Supervisory union is one of the ones that's negotiating now, so the legislature may want to pass a bill that increases, that follows the supervisory unit. But of course, it takes legislation, so that wouldn't be just through the budget. That's going to be a future policy choice. And again, they haven't come forward with the contract yet. So at some point later in session, that could be a discussion the legislature has. At this point, it's just an unknown cost. I'm done with the adjusted base if we want to take more questions or move on to the governor's budget.
All right. Go ahead, Representative Hanner.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Mr. Painter, can you tell me, my understanding is that that intent language that you referenced, the Josephson language about exempt employees following the supervisory unit, was that paid only one fiscal year that it followed? Or it's my understanding it's not currently being followed, and I'm trying to figure out if it was 1 year it was followed or 2 years.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so I think when the exempt employees received the 5% increase, the supervisory unit was in the middle of a contract that paid them 3%, then 1%, then 1%. And so at the time, the 5% increase that the exempt employees got was actually 1% more than the supervisory unit had gotten to that point. And then in FY24, they equalized by both going to the, you know, by that 1% happening for supervisory unit, nothing for the exempt employees. So they're equalized. With their new contract, to keep them keeping pace, we would need to pass a bill that increases that exempt salary schedule to keep pace if we wanted to continue to keep pace. I think right now they're roughly the same, although I would note that while legislative employees are on 40-hour work weeks like the supervisory unit, not all executive branch employees who are exempt are on a 40-hour work week, so they may not be quite comparable in terms of their hours, even if the hourly pay is comparable.
Thank you.
Representative Plum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, so just back to the slide before, I just wanted some clarification on the school debt reimbursement. That I'm sorry, you probably should know this, but I don't know what the debt is that looks like a payment. I guess I'm looking at how long would we need the moratorium to retire the debt? Are we close or?
Through the chair, Representative Colum. So the because they can refinance that debt, some of them have already stretched it out beyond FY33. I'm not sure exactly the last date, and I can get that back to the committee what that current end date is. But if they continued to refinance it, they could continue it, the payments for longer. Given that rates aren't as favorable now, maybe it's less likely than a couple of years ago, but it's at least through FY33. I'm not sure beyond that, but I'll get back to the committee with how long it would take.
Thank you.
One second. I think what we'll do is we'll take this question here in a minute, but probably go through like the next five pages, go through 25, which is what's in the budget, and then the last part is what's not in the budget, and then some outlook. So anyway, we'll go ahead and finish up our questions here, and then we'll do our next chapter. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, on since we're back on slide 18. The moratorium on school bond debt, which expires soon or could, well, it just would sunset, I guess. I'm just assuming that major maintenance goes up because we have been uninvolved in inviting districts to invest in new construction, broadly speaking. But the governor's bill, and I think we'll see this, only covers a couple schools on the major maintenance list. Do I have this right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yeah, we'll get into that on the capital budget slide, but the governor put forward one project from the school construction list and two from the major maintenance list in his capital budget.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to the governor's budget. So this is a short fiscal summary of the governor's budget. At the top is the revenue forecast, and then going to agency operations, you can see a decrease of about $100 million. Those we've talked about. There's a lot of one-time items in FY24, so that's actually an increase over the adjusted base. The big increase in the governor's budget is the permanent fund dividends, going from $881 million last year to $2.3 billion, although the energy relief kind of plays into also going out, being paid for with 24 money, but going out to Alaskans in FY25. The result is that the total budget that the governor is proposing is $1.175 billion higher than the FY24 budget, and that's 19%. Most of that increase is in the permanent fund dividend. So in the FY24 budget, there is $292.7 million available for future appropriation or lapse. The governor's currently spending $17 million of that. We're assuming in our fiscal summary that the any unspent surplus goes into the CBR. So you might notice the CBR numbers are higher than what was in OMB's fiscal summary. And that's because we're just assuming that if you don't spend it, it goes to the CBR. And we're assuming that you won't spend it if we don't have appropriations, although some amount will likely be spent. Then we have a projected pre-transfer deficit. That's our fiscal deficit of $977 million. Post-transfer, which is our what comes out of our savings, we're projecting with the governor's budget to be $982.3 million. That would deplete the SBR and then draw about $1 billion, just shy of $1 billion from the CBR. So big picture, this kind of repeats what I had just said, so I'll move on. But the largest increase, again, is the dividend. The appropriations are actually above adjusted base, but there's several areas where we expect them to be significantly higher by the time the budget is finished. So this is what's called the swoop graph. Compares last year's budget in red to this year's proposed budget by type. So we have the PFD as the largest item in the governor's budget, the Department of Education, the Department of Health. Last year, PFD was third after Education and Health. And this can help you see the relative size of various agencies and also makes it a little easier to see where are the big changes from year to year. So again, PFD stands out. Also, lower education, which is a lot is due to that one-time item, the $87.4 million not being repeated. And then a significant increase in Department of Corrections, DPS, and DOT are the ones that are going up. So I'm not going to talk too much about agency operations. Director Sanders went into it in much greater depth than I will. I'm just going to highlight a couple of items. The first is the senior benefits program. There's a decrease because of the governor backed that funding out. It'll require legislation to extend that program. So that's a reduction in the governor's budget. But again, if it's extended, that funding could come back. Significant UGF increases to the Department of Corrections and DOT, a mix of fund source changes and increments in both those departments. There's $17.3 million over the adjusted base in Department of Education because of these items that were one-time items last year that he's proposing to make permanent. That's things such as, again, the Alyeska Reading Academy or additional funding to the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. The largest reduction we see that's not just one-time items is a reduction in the Department of Health by $6.2 million to stop funding for the tuberculosis and congenital syphilis elimination plans. Those were made a temporary item by the legislature, but the governor did not put the funding back in for the FY25 budget. It was set to end in FY30. Statewide items are $365 million. The governor is fully funding school debt reimbursement, the REAA fund capitalization, state assistance retirement, all at the statutory level. It's also fully funding community assistance at the statutory level. I would note that last year he vetoed that funding. So the distribution from that program is based on one-third of the balance of the fund. The veto has the effect of making the FY25 distribution to communities, one-third of the balance would be $20 million. That's essentially enough to pay their base payments, but not the per capita payments. So the particular impact of that veto will be to high population areas. Putting in that full statutory $30 million gets the fund balance at the end of FY25 to be $70 million, which would mean that the distribution in FY26 would also be reduced, but would still be a bit above the basis. There's some other fund capitalizations proposed by the governor, $5 million for the Disaster Relief Fund. The legislature put in an FY22 supplemental of $50 million into that fund to try to cover some future disasters. We didn't put money into that fund in FY23 or 24 because we had that large balance. The governor's now asking for money again. He's asking for additional money in the AKLNG project fund, Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Corporation, and then money for the Clean Water and Drinking Water Funds. This was actually something we appropriated 2 years ago. The department wasn't quite ready to go forward with its programs at that time, so that lapsed the funding at the time, and they're asking for it again. So if you have deja vu, then we did fund it, but it's just the same funding now again once they're ready to do it.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. I'm through the chair to Director Painter. So I'm having a hard time processing one thing is with the Community Assistance Fund. So my recollection is it was this Finance Committee last year that actually added the money into the FY24 budget. It was not in the governor's budget. We added the community assistance money. That money got vetoed, and now the executive has added that money into the FY25 budget. Is there like a mechanism within that distribution of one-third of capitalization fund that I'm not understanding, or is it just struck me as strange that you would veto money to put it back in the next fiscal year that this body put in the previous fiscal year?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, so it's one-third of the balance of the fund. So the fund balance was at $90 million at the end of FY23, so $30 million went out in FY24. That leaves $60 million. So without a capitalization, a third of the fund is $20 million. As far as I can tell, it's a policy choice by the governor that he chose to veto it last year and he's choosing to put it forward this year. I can't answer the why, just what that does.
Thanks.
Okay, going on to the capital budget. So this year's,
we have a question from Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. In slide 22, which is really to me a clear picture of our big spends, I just wanted to note that I'm seeing education is a lower dollar in FY25. And, you know, of course, we see the PFD, which is the statutory amount in here. And that's north of 2,300 maybe or so. Last cycle, the red is for the number that you referred to earlier, I believe that was 1,300. And I guess my question is, you also mentioned that with this budget, it's unbalanced. And I'm just going back to my beginning notes here. We had given out $881 million through FY24, which is this number. I think down here it says 882, so I don't know what happened with that little bit of difference, but if we were to give the same amount as last year, the 1312, how would that look for that $2.3 billion? I guess it's about $1 billion deficit currently or so, and I'm just curious to know what that would look like if we gave the same the very same PFD this year. How does that change our outlook?
I mean, you can go ahead and answer that, but I'd like to say that we're early in the process.
Yes, absolutely, very early. I apologize, but just I know that a lot of folks are talking about whether or not we have any revenue, what are we going to do with it? There's statutory versus not statutory. And for the viewers who aren't really understanding the bigger picture, this really shows a lot here.
Well,
just that very basic question of if we what that would do to that overall deficit budget that we have?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I don't have the number in front of me for 1312. I do recall, because I was recently asked the question, if we did a 25% of the PMV dividend again, it would be larger this year because it's a larger PMV draw.
Okay.
And change nothing else in the governor's budget, we would have about a $400 million surplus. That would be a $914 million appropriation, if I'm remembering my math right. But that would be larger than the 1312, and then you'd also have the energy relief on top of that. So potentially a larger dollar figure. I'd have to calculate what it would be at a particular dollar figure.
Thank you, and I apologize. I recognize this is very early to discuss that, but I appreciate the imagination here.
So, well, we're looking at the governor's budget coming in, but we're looking at the legislative, but compared to last year's final budget after the legislature. So I'm sure there'll be some significant changes between now and then. Thanks.
Okay, so I won't go into the capital budget too much. I'm not really going to cover the slide at all, actually, because Director Sanders covered it all. If you have questions about the capital budget, happy to answer those. But I think the short version is that there's a huge increase in federal funds, largely because of the $1 billion for the broadband program. And then there's several new items, and then such as the HFC down payment assistance program, and then several kind of about half the budget is for matching federal funds of the general funds.
Madam Co-Chair. Yeah, if I could just slip in a quick question about sort of any general trends in the last, I don't know, 2-3 years, maybe even 4 years. Are we seeing just a general trend of more operating items being put in the capital budgets? There were a few last year, but if you could comment on that.
Yeah, Co-Chair Edgman, we're seeing a lot of that. I think this HFC down payment assistance program is an example that's probably an operating item. It's not creating a state asset. Part of the question is how do we really define that operating capital? But a number of these projects are really potentially more appropriate in the operating budget. An example would be the university project for UAF to achieve research tier one status. They're not building a new campus to do that. It's, hiring faculty, things like that. That's an operating purpose. It's not a capital purpose. And then the drone program has moved back and forth. It started out as an operating item, moved to the capital budget. Now they're proposing it in the capital budget again. A lot of that seems to be kind of ongoing costs for faculty and things like that, not necessarily actually just creating drones for state use or something that'd be creating an asset. There's also some, if looking through the details of the projects, I've noticed a few areas where, for example, the Department of Public Safety has projects that will be partially a capital project, and then part of it will be 5 years of maintenance for their aircraft. That's really something that should be in the operating budget. It's probably underfunded in the operating budget, so they put it in the capital budget if that's where they're able to get the money. But ultimately, we should be have ongoing maintenance for aircraft in the operating budget clearly identified and not put forward as temporary capital budget funding. So that is a kind of broader trend that we could look at. But there are quite a few examples this year.
And then maybe conversely, the Alyeska Reading Academy, that $5 million that we put in the budget last year went towards brick and mortar spending, did it not? Or it's projected to go towards brick and mortar spending?
Co-Chair Edgman, my understanding is that the use of the funds in FY24 has been to hire a few employees, lease a space, and then a lot of it will be to fund a conference, a training conference. So it'll be a lot of travel for teachers. I think they're flying in 100 teachers or something was the number that we heard. So that's more of an operating purpose. I'm not sure what the long-term plan is with that. Perhaps it gets into a capital purpose, but I think some of what they were saying they're using the funding on now sounds more like operating, like the travel. But I'm not quite sure what their long-term plan is.
Yeah, and that might be something I can dig in more when the OMB director comes back. But I guess suffice it to say that if operating item goes in the capital budget, the one-year sort of time period for expenditure then becomes five, right? I mean.
Well, Chair Edgman, potentially beyond that, because it's you have 5 years to start work, and as long as you have, make substantial work every 5 years, you can keep it going for decades. So at least 5 years. And, you know, one thing I would say is there's kind of two problems with operating items being in the capital budget. One is, you know, again, you're potentially stretching out things that you want done more quickly, but also in terms of kind of having a transparent, predictable budget, if you have an ongoing cost, having it reflected in your budget every year rather than every few years as you run out of money from your capital project leads to a more predictable budget. So if we say we want to make sure that we're taking care of the airplanes that the Department of Public Safety has, we should put that money in every year rather than put it in this year to cover the next 5 years, and then in 5 years we have to ask for that again. It's just more predictable funding if it's just an ongoing item and leads to a more transparent budget. We can look and say we know how much money they have and how much they have to spend for that purpose because it's there every year.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. Regarding the capital budget, I think it reflects about a 10% decrease from the previous year, fiscal year, if I'm not mistaken. Can you, for the benefit of the listening public and ourselves here, over the last 5 or 6 years, can you recall, is this trend in the capital budget in comparison to our overall spend or overall appropriations been generally going down over the years? Is that we're putting less resources into the capital budget over the last 5 years? Would you say that's safe to say?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think, well, so in FY22 we had, and 23 when we had higher revenue forecasts, we've had much larger capital budgets. We had, you know, $700 million 1 year. If you go back to FY21, 20, and really FY16 through 21, I think we were at a much lower level. We were in the, you know, $1 to $200 million a year. So this is a significant increase from that. With the federal infrastructure bill, if we put in a capital budget of $125 million like we did 1 year, we wouldn't even be matching federal funds anymore. So there's been an increase in part because of the amount needed to match federal funds has just gone up and the highway programs. It's not necessarily that we're getting more highway projects, but the costs have gone up as well as the increased infrastructure funds. But the if you compare to before 2015 then or 2016, then this capital budget would be much smaller. So it really depends on what time frame you're comparing it to. It's certainly a lot larger than those very lean budgets of 16 through 21, but much smaller than FY14, say, when it was a $2 billion UGF capital budget. That may have been FY13. Mm-hmm. 1 year we hit $2 billion.
And as a follow-up, Madam Chair, all at the same time, as you just mentioned, costs for different construction projects are going higher, not lower in general. So is it safe to say, like, for example, on the item where we're only covering two items on the school deferred maintenance list, I believe there's like 25 items on there, if I'm not mistaken. If we forego addressing the issue now, what it means for us as budgeters is even a harder time in the future addressing the issue fiscally than if we would address it now. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, I think we can see that in our deferred maintenance backlog. You know, when during the years when we were putting $100 million a year into that, the backlog was going down. This last year, it went up, I think, from year to year by, it was either $200 million or $400 million, I forget which number, but a substantial year-to-year increase because of those costs going up. So if we had invested in those projects 5 years ago, we may have been able to prevent some of that increase. At this point, we have a very large backlog of deferred maintenance, the school major maintenance, DECs working through things. There's a lot of these costs that we don't necessarily have a funding mechanism to pay for in place. Like, you know, we're putting $30 million a year from the capital income fund into deferred maintenance against a $1.8 billion backlog. It's not going to get through the backlog very quickly.
Thank you.
Okay, going on to the next slide, which is what's not in the budget. So, you know, every year we see the governor comes in with a budget, and then with amends, most years that tends to be higher. Here's a few items that we don't yet see. I don't have one I already mentioned from Representative Hannah's question of, or Representative Galvin's question about child care. That's not on here because I don't know what that cost could be. These are just the large things where at least I can put a number on something. So in education, the governor did not put forward a BSA increase or outside the formula funding. There was $87.4 million outside the formula last year. The bill on the that was read across in second reading today in the in this body, I think, has a $220 million price tag. So who knows where we'll end up. It's probably not a $0 increase. There's also a pending issue in the federal disparity test that could cause the state cost to increase by $89.1 million if that goes against us. We may not get clarity in that for a number of months, but it's a thing to be mindful of when we're building our budget, that that cost could end up coming in higher if we fail the disparity test, which is possible this year due to some issues with how some districts have funded themselves.
And that's a ruling, or that's a that we will, you know what the date for that is?
Chair Johnson, so we typically submit to the federal government our test in February. They won't, if the department is able to find a way to pass, great, then we don't have to worry about it. If they have to change their methodology, or if the federal government says, no, you're not accounting for everything, it could drag on longer. The last time we had initially in FY21, I think, the FY21 disparity test, we failed the initial version, then had a resubmittal. It dragged on about a year between the time that we failed initially and between when it was cleared up. So we don't really have a good time frame on how long it will take to completely resolve that issue. It may drag on for a while.
Well, I guess what I'm asking or trying to get to is if you want to consider that or be aware that it's hanging out there, you know, if we need to set it aside or in anticipation of the possibility that it might come in, or we just figure out a way to fund it if it does. So it's a decision we'll have to make as
and
we put the budget
Johnson,
together.
We may have better information as the department is working to prepare it. They don't have all the financial data from all the districts yet, so they can't really put that together yet. Once they're able to, we may see how whether it's as serious of an issue as some fear it is or not, but we just don't have the data yet.
So they'll have some kind of idea, probably. Edmund.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of like the Renewable Energy Grant Program, possibly weatherization, certainly going back a few pages, you know, ASME, ATA funding. There's a whole host of other things that could be added to this list, right? And I don't know if you can think of any other items out there of that nature, but you start stacking them all up and they begin to become real money after a while. And I think this is just an impressive list by itself, but again, I'm thinking of other things that are out there as well, too.
Yeah, Co-Chair Edgman, there's certainly things you could add to this list. These are kind of the big items, you know, and I'm using like $20 million or more as the threshold. If you start to a lower threshold, there's potentially a lot more increases that could get added on. So just to go through the list with Medicaid, as the OMB director said a couple of days ago, the projection that the department came out with was prepared too late to include in the governor's budget. It indicates a need of an additional $22.6 million of general funds. That estimate will be refined for the governor's amended budget for a future amendment. The senior benefits program is set to sunset and is not included in the governor's budget. If that is extended and based on, you know, the number of bills and the variety of sponsors, it seems likely that it'll be extended. The cost had been $20.8 million before. The Alaska Energy Authority received a $206.5 million federal grant to upgrade the electrical grid. That grant will require equal state matching funds. We could potentially pay those over a few years, but a lot of those funding mechanisms may still require some upfront investments. For example, they may be able to repurpose some existing bond money to cover it. They would have to go back to their bondholders and ask for permission. That may take some time, and they may not get permission, and if we don't put some funds forward, they may not be able to start work on the project this summer. They are working on a funding package, but the need this session, according to AEA, is likely to be at least $30 to $35 million, or could be higher, could be a bit lower if they're able to get that down. But at least for preliminary numbers, probably put a placeholder around that size. The Alaska Marine Highway is getting very complicated to explain it fully, but there could be a gap up to $38 million. There could be no gap between what we are able to run in terms of vessel availability and crew availability and the amount of federal money. This last year, and for calendar year 24, our current year, we applied for $66 million of federal funds, but only received $38 million. That opened up a big gap. And so we received less than we were eligible for. The Secretary of Transportation has significant flexibility in how he awards the funds. And in this case, he had awarded some extra funds in the previous year and then a little bit less this year. And then also, even though Alaska is the only state that really qualifies, they can open the eligibility at the Secretary's discretion. And they chose to open that eligibility and gave, I think, $21 million to American Samoa. So Alaska ends up with less. So the result is that there's a gap in the current calendar year. Going into the next year, they haven't even started on that application process. We don't really know what kind of gap they could be looking for. If it's the same as this year and we don't have backstop, it could be as much as $38 million. If they get more grants, it could be much smaller. It's a huge unknown. So this is kind of the maximum, is $38 million. But there is a potential hole, but a lot of uncertainty moving forward on Marine Highway because of the experience this year of not getting all that we were eligible for. And then, as I mentioned, there's three unions that are currently negotiating. We may see increases from those. We'll see how large those increases are, but three of those unions are fairly sizable, or all three unions are fairly sizable. So we could see a pretty large increase based on recent inflation. So happy to pause here before we move on to long-term projections on the next slide.
Through the chair, is there any need? You talked about disaster fund capitalization earlier. Would you, that's going to be a policy call, right? But would you potentially add that to the list for FY25? It's on the slide here in front of us.
Co-chair Edgman, probably not, because with that $50 million capitalization in FY22, the department has been able to use that. A lot of our disasters have ended up becoming at least partially federal funded that have reduced the state's costs substantially. So I think there is a fairly healthy balance of general funds still available in that fund. I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but I can get that to the committee. But I'm not particularly concerned about the fund balance right now because of that large infusion we gave a couple of years ago.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going back to the Alaska Marine Highway and the potential $38 million shortfall. Is the issue, or not the issue, but the funding source of toll credits relate to anything to that $38 million, or is that a total unrelated issue?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, that's unrelated. That's on the capital side. So that's a choice in how the governor has chosen to meet the state's matching requirement for the Testamina. One of the options for meeting that matching requirement is to use other federal revenue as what's called toll credits, because we have used the Marine Highway Fund, that's our receipts collected for maintenance in the past. We're eligible to use federal funds as toll credits to match. That's not required. We could use that federal money for additional projects and match it with other sources. That's a policy choice of how to fund those items.
Thank you.
Okay, going on to the long-term outlook and the governor's 10-year plan. So our modeling baseline assumes that the FY25 adjusted base grows with inflation. That includes in FY25, so inflation on top of the adjusted base. And that all statewide items are funded to the statutory level, including the PFD. And then we can see policy changes applied to that baseline. And I would note that if you add up all those items on my last slide to the governor's budget, it is more than inflation. So I'm not sure if that's necessarily a realistic starting point. That's just kind of an objective one that we've used in the past. As we get farther with the governor's amended budget and all that, happy to model other scenarios as requested by a committee. So with our baseline assumptions, the deficits start at $1.1 billion in FY25. They increase to a peak of about $1.9 billion in FY31, fall off a little after that. In the governor's 10-year plan, there are several policy changes relative to that baseline that would reduce the deficit. They still show deficits each year, and we'll talk about that when we get to the governor's 10-year plan, but starting off with our baseline. And before I get to the baseline, one thing I would just emphasize is, you know, back to my very first slide, the legislature has not just run us off a cliff the last 6 years. We have run relatively balanced budgets. So the purpose of this is not to say we are going to run off a cliff, is to say if we followed the current statutes on the books with the PFD and other items and our current revenue, our current budget levels, what would happen? So you can see policy changes relative to that. It's not, again, we're not saying this is a likely scenario. I think this is a very unlikely scenario. So this is the first time I've shown the models. I'm going to take a minute to orient the committee to these slides. You're probably all familiar with them from last year. The top line here is the surplus and deficit in millions of dollars. So in FY24, we have a surplus, and then going into deficits, $1.1 billion to $1.9 billion over the years. This left graph shows the revenue and budget. The blue bar is the traditional revenue, the oil and non-oil, non-investment revenue, or non-POMV revenue. The green is our POMV revenue. And then the gold bars here is the draws from our savings account, the CBR and SBR. The black line is the budget for each of those years, including the PFD. So to balance the budget, we need to meet the bar and the line. In FY25 and 26, we project that you do that by drawing from our savings accounts. Those run dry in FY27, and we have a gap. That means we have an unbalanced budget. We have an unfilled deficit. We could choose to fill that from the ERA. That's the next slide, but that's not automatic. This, I think, showing without ERA draws first kind of shows you the size of the problem before you get those compounding effects. I would note, then in the right, we have our budget reserves. The yellow is the CBR and SBR balance. We leave $500 million in the CBR for cash flow needs. And then the realized ERA balance, which we see even without overdraws, is declining based on what we talked about, again, probably 10 slides ago or so. So then at the bottom, we have the effective POMV draw rate. That includes those overdraws being... if they were part of the POMV draw to make that overdraw, what would that be? And the PFD per person in the scenario. So the statutory dividend, that would be $3,654 estimated in FY25 in our model. So this is our baseline, again, if you don't make any policy changes and with unfilled deficits. Slide 29 shows if we filled those deficits from draws from the ERA, we would draw the ERA. That's the red bars here. Draws the ERA balance to zero by FY33, so there's still a gap here in FY33. So if you chose to just run large deficits and run out of money with no changes, we would not even have the ERA by the end of FY33. See those overdraws impacting the effective POMV draw down at the bottom. So this is, again, with no policy changes, just running the current statutes and current budget up with inflation.
Madam Co-Chair, it just seems every year we go through this projections with the statutory PFD when everybody knows we just can't afford it as much as some of us would like to have it, unfortunately. But it was, I think the OMB director a couple days ago, maybe I misheard it, but basically said the governor is required to put it, the statutory budget, a PFD into his proposed budget. You know, maybe I'm quibbling here, but I think the government could put anything in this budget. He's not required to put any, you know, statutory anything into his budget. I think it was last year that that you came back and you did a 25-75 analysis and 50-50 analysis and things like that. But it's just, I don't know, a little misleading for somebody in the general public to look at these numbers knowing that it doesn't reflect the reality. And it's to me, it's an annoyance. So, I guess my point is, you can say yay or nay or sidestep if you want, but the governor, a governor is not required to put these numbers in because there's a statutory formula. They can put whatever they want into the budget, proposed budget.
Co-Chair, that's correct. The governor can put forward any number, and there are a number of statutes that we don't follow year to year, and that the governor does not follow in his 10-year plan. That's policy choice. From our standpoint on modeling, we start with the current statute. If there's proposals to do something different, we're happy to model that. We don't want to be picking scenarios as a nonpartisan agency. That's for you policymakers to pick what scenarios you'd like to see. And we're happy to run any scenario that you would like us to run. But we're not going to pick our favorite formula and run it. We'll run what the governor shows and then the current statute, unless you have other scenarios for us. Okay, getting into the governor's 10-year plan. So the governor's 10-year plan makes a couple of policy changes. Agency operations and the capital budget in the governor's 10-year plan grow at 1.5% instead of inflation. Our assumption of that is 2.5%. He does not fund community assistance with unrestricted general funds after FY25, so his current budget does that. That assumption does not carry forward, so that's a policy change that he's making. There's a couple of assumption differences in our model that are not really policy items that are different than the 10-year plan. I just want to call them out so you know why our numbers don't quite match theirs. One is a longstanding difference that supplementals and LAPs in the governor's 10-year plan, they assume that lapsing appropriations and supplementals cancel out. We've included a supplemental placeholder of $50 million. That's based on kind of the pre-COVID average of the difference between supplementals and lapsing appropriations. Since COVID, both of those numbers have been much, much higher. It's much harder to make a comparison that's fair. So we're kind of still using that pre-COVID placeholder. It's just a placeholder. I'm not sure that I could really empirically justify any particular number because of the extreme volatility of both supplementals and LAPs the last few years. We also have a placeholder for new school debt after the moratorium ends, based on kind of historical numbers. It's possible that we'll see more school debt because there's a backlog of projects. It's possible that districts won't want to use that program because we haven't had a history of funding it every year. I'm not sure, so we're just using that historical number. And then there's another difference this year that was a timing difference. The fall revenue sources book in the governor's 10-year plan used a preliminary number from the Permanent Fund Corporation that actually didn't really reflect their final scenario, and it's not a public number, so we can't really match it. We're using the figures from the Permanent Fund Corporation's November history and projections report. November is picked because that's the number that came out around when the governor's budget was released, but it wasn't available, so they had a bit of a timing mismatch. So we're showing a bit higher POMV numbers and slightly lower dividend numbers than the 10-year plan showed. But it's just a timing difference in which forecast we're able to use.
So, I don't want to skim over this, but on the next two pages, would you hit what you think is the most important pieces between your analysis and the governor's 10-year plan? I mean, we can look at the 10-year plan and we can talk about it all we want, but we've already said that we recognize that it leads us down a path that we probably aren't going, but in your analysis, and you spent a lot of time with this, I've seen it I don't know how many times, maybe hitting the real kernels in here that you think people at this table need to take away from this and remember, because otherwise we're looking at this and it's hard to, you know, what's the point of internalizing things that may not really be all that necessary?
Sure. Chair Johnson, I think so. This next slide compares our baseline to the governor's 10-year plan. The big takeaway from this to me is that inflation is very powerful. So, you know, compound interest is a very powerful force, that a 1% change in the difference, you know, between 1.5% growth and 2.5% growth starts out very small, but by the end of a 10-year period, that's a lot of money. So it's a pretty sizable difference between those baselines, despite really just being a difference in inflation assumptions. So it goes, you know, it's a nearly $700 million difference just because of inflation by FY33. So then this is the governor's 10-year plan in our model. And it, again, this is, these are numbers very similar to the 10-year plan. The point I would make on this is that the governor's 10-year plan statute says that he's supposed to balance expenditures and revenue and available fund sources, and his 10-year plan runs the CBR to negative $10 billion. I'm not sure if that really balances fund sources, and what I don't have much more to comment on that. But his 10-year plan is not really a full fiscal plan. You can't follow this and get out of the fiscal woods. So I don't know if you really want to talk about it much other than to note that in past years we've had, you know, a $900 million new revenue placeholder, and you can see the impact of that. Or one year he had five different plans to look at. This year he provided one plan that doesn't balance. So, yeah, as you said, there's probably not a whole lot of point to keep talking about that, but that's what he submitted.
I mean, I guess just to make note, if we're required, say, to you know, I don't know that we're required to put all the statutory pieces for the PFD and so on. And we've talked about the structural deficit, but I think that's kind of the. I don't know how much more you want to add to that. We need to really add to that.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, I'll add to that because I was here when the 10-year plan legislation was 2008 was put into law, if I remember right, to Reverend Hawker. I know what the 10-year plan has become today definitely is counter or violates the spirit of that original legislation. That was supposed to be a viable sort of look ahead into time and not just a document that any governor can use one of the slides said, to sort of put policy sort of implications in there. And it's really just not, you know, I don't think that document is used. A couple of days ago, I asked if it was used by the credit rating agencies to approach, I don't think it is. That's the last thing they'd want to be able to put forward because it's not realistic. And last year, you know, we saw carbon capture money in there that is dissolved this year, just disappeared, it appeared, and it disappeared. It almost just seems like there needs to be a retooling of what this is supposed to be because it is, you know, basically – sees to be an effective tool or even a believable representation of what's going forward in many respects. And, you know, just Madam Co-Chair, just picking up where you left off. So to your point, if I may just wrap up, I don't even know if it deserves more discussion than what we're doing now.
Well, I guess I'll just make a statement that we're, you know, all of this aside, that means that we don't necessarily have a lot of guidance, but we, as the legislature, as this finance committee, we have a responsibility without really a lot of sideboards that we're going to have to sort some of this out and continue to do so. And I know we have a commitment from all of our members to make that happen. So anyway, is there any concluding comments from... Thank you. Representative Tomaszewski, or first I'll go to Director Painter. Do you have any additional comments to conclude your presentation?
Well, first, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to present. And I would just say on the 10-year plan and modeling, we're happy to model scenarios that the committee feels is more realistic. You know, we usually start with the governor's budget and their plan. That's not a particularly meaningful starting point to the committee. We're happy to start with a different starting point that you feel like is more reasonable.
All right. Very good. And then Representative Edgman. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair. Just thank you, Lexi, for this good information. It really makes it clear that what we've done over the past many years is balanced our budgets on the backs of the people of Alaska in the reduction, or I should say tax, of the permanent fund dividend. You know, it's clearly shown in the years where we had a balanced budget, that's what's happening. And really this regressive tax on really the most vulnerable people of the state of Alaska is how this has been happening. And I really appreciate some of the comments on how we need to really be thoughtful and in the way we conservatively look at our budgets. And so I just look forward to that process and seeing how we can balance this budget without hurting the most vulnerable people in the state. Thanks.
Representative Edson.
Yeah, I just want to say, generally speaking, thank you. This was a really great presentation. Your knowledge of all the intricacies is pretty impressive. And it's also, you know, speaking of balanced, it's balanced with your practical experience. You've been in the building for a number of years, different capacities. And this has been really informative. And maybe, Matt, co-chair, and others around the table, we can have you back and model some different scenarios that maybe are more true to what our sort of sense is of the budget going forward. And, you know, maybe in a 2-3 year timeline too as well, because really when you get out past a certain period of time, predicting commodities and oil prices and things like that just become throwing darts at the wall. And so maybe a shorter period of time would be more useful to us. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. I do appreciate the presentation. And at 3:30, well, let me just go ahead and talk about what we're going to do on a future meeting. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Thursday, January 25th, 1:30 p.m. Committee will be hearing HB 89, an act relating to daycare assistance, sponsored by Representative Colomb, and HB 50, an act relating to carbon capture, referred to the House Rules Committee at the request of the governor. And that, at that time, Representative Foster will be chairing those meetings. But seeing no further business before the committee at 3:30, we are adjourned.